Welcome to Founders in Biotech. In this podcast, biotech entrepreneurs share their founders' journey and scientific achievements. I'm your host, Sergey Glinka. Today's guest is Elaine Ham, or Ham, depending how you pronounce where I come from. So Elaine did her graduate and postgraduate studies in biochemistry and microbiology. Early on, she took the role of technology development at the University of Oklahoma, where she built skills in assessing and spinning out new technologies. We're going to talk about that. After several years at the venture capital company I2E, Elaine became the CEO of Accel, or Acceli Biopharma. Elaine is also founder of Ascent BioVentures, a pharmaceutical accelerator company. She founded Kairos Pharmaceuticals and is currently also the president of Autologic Pharmaceutics. Autologic Pharmaceutics is a clinical stage company developing new treatments for hearing loss and hearing-related diseases. Thank you so much, Elaine, for joining us today on Founders in Biotech.
I'm happy to be here, even though here is my own house, but yes, I'm happy to be a part of the podcast.
Great. I'm actually very much looking forward to our conversation because the experience that I have as an entrepreneur, and you cover kind of the whole founder's journey from the spin-out to leading a biotech company. So very much looking to it. First of all, we start with you. Where did you grow up? What inspired actually to become a scientist and go into, like, let's start there. And then what drove you to biotech?
Yeah. So I hate to say this, but it's, I was inspired to become a scientist by watching not a great and scientifically accurate movie, but the movie Outbreak, which was
this one, yeah, with Dustin Hoffman, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they showed up in Africa in these biohazard suits, and it was like the first time I'd seen scientists outside of a lab, and I sort of saw that science could be much more than being inside a lab. But I really thought it'd be cool to go study these level 4 pathogens, and turns out horribly, horribly clumsy in the lab, should never be around a level 3, much less a level 4 pathogen. But, it got me interested in seeing science in a different way. And then, yeah, I actually still stuck with my music major for a while and hurt my hand and couldn't continue on. And so naturally became a microbiologist.
Yeah.
So. And then with the microbiology degree, I really, it was just one of those sciences that stuck with me. And it was around in my childhood, whether I realized it or not. I did have a microscope growing up. And actually, my parents got my brother the microscope, and I stole it from his room. And anytime I found a bug or cut myself, I would look at it under the microscope and see, you know, what it looked like. So I think I was destined to be a microbiologist. I just didn't realize it at the time.
That's so cool. The Outbreak movie. Okay. I've seen it too. I remember it. But it explains actually the microbiology background.
Yep. That's how microbiology.
So biochemistry, microbiology, and after the studies, how did you make the transition? So, okay, here's the science, but what I'm interested in is actually how the science is translating to a commercialization stage, whatever.
Yeah, so it really strangely came from my being a lazy graduate student, to be honest. I always tried to find ways to work smarter, not harder, so I was working on this bacterial toxin that took 2 weeks to purify, and it was such a pain. You had to sleep in the lab sometimes when the HPLC just took too long, and I just really hated it. And so I found a way to make it go from 2 weeks to 2 days, and that really, out of my giant dissertation, that was the only thing that was commercializable. So, but it was interesting to see, like, this helped me, this could probably help others do the same thing. And so we ended up filing a patent application, and it got licensed out to a company. And that was sort of my first taste of the business side of science, of being a scientist and having something that I made go to the labs of others. And that was really it felt really rewarding to have, you know, something tangible like that. And that's how I got interested in technology transfer too. So I didn't immediately go from grad school to tech transfer, mm-hmm. but I did go to the bench at a startup pharmaceutical company where I was a chemist for a while. And I just didn't really enjoy it. There was something that I loved about science in grad school, which was the creativity. I love being really creative. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we use zebrafish to look at bacterial toxins. And it was just a weird, fun experience to do things that way. But when you're at the bench at a pharmaceutical company, you have SOPs and regulations and sort of checkboxes that you have to check. And it, very importantly so, but it really sort of took the creative side out of it for me. But I had that sort of taste of tech transfer when I was on the scientist side. And so joined the tech transfer office, started me on that path.
So was the technology commercialized, or was the experience that you went through how, like, the idea, okay, it helped me, it could help other scientists, like, not to sleep in the lab?
Yeah, so I think the process was really fascinating, and I was always sort of, like, interested in learning, period. And so understanding that there was this whole other side to science of patents and business and commercialization, and that this was a way to take something that you're working on and actually make it clinically or commercially relevant. Okay. That was really interesting. But yeah, no, I eventually received a check for it. But I think it took a couple of years.
Okay. It sounds like at this stage already, you kind of have the perspective, like the full spectrum of science, the commercialization of science, and kind of creating value outside of like academia, right?
Yeah, it looks like I have a, I mean, if you look at my resume, it looks like I really plan things out.
Yeah.
You know, being, you know, all throughout the, you know, to now end up being a startup founder, it really didn't feel like that at all. I mean, I think at all points I had no idea what it is that I wanted to do. I just either didn't want to do what I was currently doing or saw something that was really interesting and wanted to learn more. So, or a combination of the two. So it looks, everything that I've done to date is exactly what I do now every mm-hmm. day. So, I mean, it's been mm-hmm. gathering sort of these pieces and these skill sets that have helped me become a better entrepreneur. Definitely didn't plan on being an entrepreneur though. So.
But your career looks really, from the outside perspective, really like engineer to come, like studying,
yeah.
like tech transfer, like venture, and then accelerator, like seeding more
looks
companies.
Really well. No, it was a lot of quarter life crisis and what do I want to do with my life and a lot of angst for sure. So,
transitioning from the like tech transfer, technology development to I2E, what mm-hmm. was what was the driver? Like, okay, I know how, like, it's actually the next stage for a startup company.
Yeah.
But what skills from this tech transfer or technology development were useful in like more in the VC context?
Yeah. From the get-go is really understanding the mechanistic side of getting technologies out of the university. So really understanding how a university works of, you know, why would they file a patent? What do they need to file a patent? What's involved in a license agreement? And what does a university expect when they have a startup company come from their university? And so when I joined the venture capital firm, I had two different hats. One was to learn the venture side. So that was for me. I wanted to understand the financial side. I wanted to understand, you know, what it took to build a company and understanding what a pro forma is. And the other side, the other hat that I wore was to start a university accelerator. So a program mm-hmm. designed specifically to help take things from the university and put them either into a startup company or a larger, more established company. And it was based a lot off of the I-Corp program that the National Science Foundation had created. And we morphed it over the few years I was there at I2E to a much shorter program, but really still focus on the idea of finding a product market fit based on what your customers want to have, and then understanding who your customers are. So, but the two hats are what I got a little something out of it. I understood the venture side. And then the other side was, you know, really understanding how to take a technology from the university.
It makes a lot of sense. So there is a lot of discussion like how to assess the technology, where's the product market fit. But to my experience, the bottleneck for at least for founders is often these processes, like what are the contracts, what are the what's the deal the university wants to have. I've seen deals that were like crazy, and it kind of stopped the startup, so they just stopped.
Yeah.
So and managing this process, I think, is super important. And what would be the regulations between different countries are very different, but maybe you have kind of one number one advice, like what to look for the process, or there's the debate of like early filing patterns, what kind of strategy, what would be your number one advice for this process
of being on one side of the table, of sort of, you know, if you're working with a university, whether you're trying to license a technology or you're the founder and you want to license your own technology, is understanding what they're having to deal with on a university side. So, you know, what are their metrics? Do they care about getting their patent costs reimbursed, or is that something that can be put off a little bit? Do they have to have a license fee from the initial signing, or can that be an equity instead? So really taking the time to sit down of like, how does this university handle things? Because every university is completely different. So when I first start with a technology, after meeting the scientists and liking the technology, I get to know the university and how they do business and try to adjust accordingly, because it's just knowing how they're motivated makes the negotiation process so much easier. And just picking up the phone and having a conversation of like, why is this particular point? We've gone back and forth. I'm in the middle of a negotiation now, and we've gone back and forth on specific things. And then finally, it's just like, hey, this is why it's really, really important to me. Is that important to you? And no, it turned out it wasn't that big a deal, and we came across a solution. But you have to understand what motivates them.
Yeah, so I'm involved a lot of in like enterprise, like B2B enterprise. Sounds like a sales process. Understanding the other side, like what are incentives? Maybe there are incentives like to increase the patent portfolio, etc., and figuring this out and align with own plans.
Absolutely.
So and then after I2E, you decide to like create your own accelerator for biotech companies. So I was researching and I was like, wow, this is interesting. I haven't heard a lot of examples on that, because it's quite complex, the biotech field, and the technologies are always complex. How did the idea emerge? Were you carrying around for years and that was the right timing?
Well, actually, so when I left the venture firm, I joined one of my clients, which was an accelerator. So Accela Biopharma was an accelerator. And so we managed a portfolio of different assets and different companies, and we were the management team for each of those individual companies. And so where Ascend, my current company, comes from is actually from the failure of Accela Biopharma. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of lessons learned from that company, and what would you do different? The board sort of, you know, still loved the idea of an accelerator. The board said, hey, you know, why don't you take some lessons learned and reboot it? And that's where Ascend comes from. Mm-hmm. And what Accela, you know, had was, I mean, we really hit the statistics of startups in the sense of 3 out of 4 of our companies failed. So we were actually pretty aligned with what the industry sort of expectations are, but there were just some tweaks that I did. And so first and foremost was making the Ascend is entirely virtual. So Accela had all of this lab space. My first thing I did when I joined Accela was to start an animal facility. So I started an animal facility. I mean, we had all of the bells and whistles, but with bells and whistles comes a lot of capital, and it can be really expensive. And what's applicable for one company may not be applicable for another portfolio company. So one may need a huge med chem lab and one may not. Mm-hmm. And so really by making it virtual, and this was even pre-pandemic, which was very helpful that we were already used to being virtual, but it allowed us to be really nimble with how we did things. And I also wasn't expected to be the expert in every single portfolio company, that we would hire management based on what the asset needed. So we mm-hmm. didn't have to be the expert across diabetes, infectious disease, and hearing loss. We would go find that expertise, and that's helped a lot too.
Okay, understood. So it's kind of the transition from providing the infrastructure and kind of trying to fit in into infrastructure and going actually virtual, like virtual biotech and probably virtually operate and also the accelerator program. Okay.
Yeah. And that allowed us to find interesting technology and great management wherever they are. I mean, we are not tied to having a management team be here in Oklahoma. They can be in Boston. The technology can be from California. It doesn't matter. We're adaptable, and that allows us to just sort of pair the perfect asset with the perfect team.
That's very interesting. I was recently in a conversation with a founder of a tech company, and they started, like, they realized we are operating in a niche, and they started mm-hmm. to recruit for their company, like, virtually, like, globally. Pre-pandemic. So, and it turned out to be a very good strategy for them, but it makes a lot of sense also in science and biotech to do the same.
Yeah, absolutely.
So although it from the outside perspective, your career seems to be very clear and engineered, and it was a kind of organic process, it still covers like all stages from being at the bench at the university to like accelerating and investing in and managing leading biotech companies. So a couple of questions for the community, which are super valuable, I think, is scientists at the university, maybe they have something like you have a process attack and they think about like starting up a company. What number one step from the scientist perspective would you recommend to, or like, what should they consider first as scientists?
Yeah. It's how they want to be involved in a company. What does that look like? When they say they want to start a company, does that mean that they want to leave the university and go raise money and be the CEO of the company? Do they still want to be within the university? Do they really just want the product to get out there somehow, some way? And if it's them or someone else, they don't care. I think really understanding how you see your engagement with the company from the offset is really important, because that sets expectations. Mm-hmm. If you really just want to make sure that the asset gets out, that could be a completely different, you know, startup company than if you want to be the one that starts it and have the control. So understanding sort of what you want as a role, ideally, is, I think, number one thing to start out with.
Totally agree with that. I've seen programs that say, you must become a salesperson. And then it's the worst advice you can give to a scientist, because scientists are driven by complexity, solving problems, curiosity, not a transaction.
Right. And sometimes, you know, part of like, I mean, if you're in drug development, like I am, a lot of the things that are required, you know, by the company to move the company forward are going to be pretty boring experiments. I mean, they're not going to be the really, truly interesting discoveries that you're used to at an academic institute. Sometimes they're just, hey, when I inject the drug, where does it go? That's not necessarily always the scientific dream they hope to actually discover, though. So,
yeah.
Sorry, the mailman's here, so that's why the dogs.
And like once they decide, I want to step out of the university. And what would you recommend? There are platform companies, there are single asset companies. Not in terms of what is better, from the scientific. I'm emphasizing the scientific perspective. Is it go big or occupy initial growth from there?
That's such an interesting question. I have been part of single asset companies, and I have been a part of platform companies, and platform companies that have been successful and some that have just been absolute disaster. And so on the offset of that question, I mean, I think it depends on what makes sense. So if you have a platform to technology technology. So you have a technology that actually enables the creation of multiple drugs, for example. That's great. Investors really, a lot of investors like to have multiple shots on goal. Some don't. Some are single asset, you know, type investors, and that's fine. But I've, more often than not, I find that investors like to have platforms or at least, you know, multiple indications. But you have to make sure that you aren't spreading yourself too thin. Mm-hmm. And so that's the key, because it's when you have something that can go in a lot of different directions, you can also get pulled in a lot of different directions. Yeah. And that's really challenging. And so I would always say, like, if you have a platform, pick the lowest hanging fruit to get to a proof of concept. And then on the side or concomitantly, you can develop the business case for the secondary applications. But, you might be able to do a couple of experiments that checks the boxes in a multiple different, you know, buckets. But the biggest risk is something I call sort of shiny object syndrome, where you just get pulled a number of different directions. And being an entrepreneur, you're going to get feedback and advice from so many different sources, investors, board members, other entrepreneurs, that if you listen to every one of them, you would probably go crazy, because they're all going to have a slightly different advice and sometimes drastically different.
I'm guilty. I have the syndrome. I'm coping with it probably, but...
It's hard.
But how do you deal with it? I really struggle, because once you have tech and you know the market, you see, okay, we can do this and that.
No, it really is hard. So I think that, because you can end up spending your money to move five projects forward just one inch. Mm-hmm. And I've been part of those companies, and those companies don't exist anymore because of that. We didn't have any more money because we spent all of our money on everything and nothing all at the same time. And so, you know, really try to think about, you know, what's the one project that you can move 5 miles ahead versus five projects one inch, and really think about the Venn diagram of market and customer feedback, and then overlay on top of that experiments that are very inexpensive, that can provide really clear sort of go, no-go decision points, and that can really move to a very clear proof of concept. So, and then on top of that, finding the things that you actually care about, because what's worse is to be working on something that you're following the money versus something that you actually care about. And I started a company that was on an indication that was really hot at the time, and I knew it was going to be popular. And so I was chasing the money more than I was chasing my passion. And the company didn't work out scientifically, but I could feel that I wasn't excited about it too. So, I mean, it's complicated. It's a lot of overlaying pieces, but you kind of have to find what's the project in that Venn diagram in the very center that sort of checks all of those boxes.
Yeah,
it's hard though.
Elaine is really helpful. It's really it's like a pill for those shiny object syndrome impacted founders. So I think it's worth visualizing it, because I started to focus on timeline, what actually has a higher probability of success, and focus on that. But looking at the market, what has worked with clients, but combining it with what you care about, it is adding additional layer. So thanks for sharing that.
Absolutely. It's hard. It's really hard to balance all those things, and you're going to get feedback from a number of different people. So you kind of have to think about feedback as data. I mean, it is data. I mean, you have to see, like, is there a common thread of what people are asking for? And that can be added as another sort of layer of the Venn diagram. So keeping track, creating a database of the feedback you've gotten from different customers and what that can actually lead to in terms of your value proposition, and focusing on that.
Okay. So that's an exciting conversation. So another question is, like, geography. There are hubs, biotech hubs, but not all founders can actually move there or reach out for whatever reasons. Now you have a virtual accelerator program. Do you think things have changed?
Yeah, no, I mean, to be fair, so virtual for pharmaceutical, it has been ongoing for quite some time. And so we've had CROs and CMOs, and we're kind of used to that. So contract research organizations and contract manufacturing organizations, for your listeners that may not know.
Yeah.
And so we've whether, you know, we realize it or not, we've been sort of working towards a virtual operation and being able to outsource, you know, certain things. And the drug development process lends itself to that. There's, it's very modular. I mean, you have preclinical, manufacturing, and then clinical, and all of those are very different skill sets and different areas of expertise. And so it was sort of built to be done virtually in a lot of ways. With the pandemic though, I think that it forced the business side to become virtual too. And that's been the piece that's been a little bit slower in getting people to want to do business via a Zoom or a call and getting comfortable with the idea that you can work from home. I mean, unless you're a scientist, you're going to have to be at the bench, unfortunately, but if you're on the administrative side, I mean, you can do it from home and get a lot done from home as well. And so that has been a little bit harder, I think. And the pandemic has made that much easier and probably more tolerated. I think also the business development side, people are realizing that virtual conferences can work. They can be done. Business partnerships don't have to always start face to face. I mean, we signed a deal with Boehringer Ingelheim, and I still haven't met any of them in person. but we've built a relationship over Zoom and meetings for quite some time and done that successfully. And I think being able to do business development virtually is so important for startup companies. And I hope we continue it. I mean, it's just really expensive to go to a conference. I mean, and that cost can be too challenging, I think, for some startup companies. And so I hope that we'll continue it. There's still just the things that happen in person that is still hard to do over, you know, virtual or Zooms. And that's just natural sort of networking and connections that you get from being at a conference. But you still are going to have that balance. But I think that we've shown that you can grow a relationship and a collaboration without being there physically.
But how about access to capital? Has this changed also, gravitated towards virtual? Like companies that are not in Boston, San Francisco, or like those hubs?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, I mean, a lot of the BD conferences that I've gone to in the before times have gone to a virtual process, and that's allowed me to do fundraising virtually. It's allowed me to do partnership development virtually. They're starting to slip back into some more of a hybrid, maybe even more of an in-person. So I hope that we still keep that ability to be virtual though, because for startups that don't have capital to go to JP Morgan, it's really still going to be important.
Yeah. Okay. So we are in the early stage of startups, and especially from so I had mentors who said, okay, this is important for the market. Don't like your fancy ideas don't matter for the industry because they have to solve particular problems. So what would you recommend from BD perspective for scientists who are just starting? Like they have some ideas. Oh, it could be useful for this company. It could become very big. How to gain the market knowledge, market insights? Like, is it other particular tactics maybe, or should they find mentors, build a network?
It's yes, all of the above.
All of them.
Well, I mean, so always keeping in mind your customer, and the customer is the person that will pay you. And that's a hard concept, because I think that we're trained to sort of think of the absolute end user, so patient or a doctor. But oftentimes, particularly in drug development and biotech, you're going to get acquired. And that's my goal. So like I like to operate in the early stage development and then pass it off to a partner to do the later stage stuff. And so when I'm thinking of my customers, I'm thinking of what does Boehringer Ingelheim want to see? What does a Pfizer want to see? And so I know. And again, they're going to be the boring questions. But it makes raising money so much easier when you are pitching to investors and you've said, no, the experiments that I'm proposing to do and you using your money are the experiments that that Pfizer told me that they wanted to see. And so they understand that you have a very clear goal with their funds, and that it's with a potential partner's blessing. And so when I look at an asset, the first thing I do before I even go raise money is ask a pharmaceutical, go around and ask pharmaceutical companies, what kind of data package would you like to see? When would you acquire a technology like this? Am I going to have to go all the way to human trials? If so, that's a different sort of fundraising, you know, perspective. So
that's super helpful. Never heard that. I think that's very helpful. Because those questions are really hard. Like, you cannot answer. I could answer by myself because, like, I'm not an advisor. But I think that's a really nice strategy to talk to customers, to clients, and understand their perspective.
Absolutely. And it makes fundraising so much easier. So rather than putting the pharma partners at the end of the process, start with them and understand. And then that's when you have a platform too, that can be challenging because you'll have some people that only care about the platform. They wanted to have something in their portfolio that can be a platform, and others may just be very interested in one single indication. And so how do you manage that? And, you know, where you're again, gathering data, you're just gathering data and understanding, you know, what are the common themes? I've heard everybody say that they want to understand route of administration. I've heard everybody say that they like this particular animal model. That's another key. I've worked with a diabetes company and we did a diabetes study in the wrong animal model. It was a great model for diabetes, but it wasn't the one that industry cared about. Mm. So we had to repeat everything in a completely different mouse model. And that man, I wish we had known that sooner. Yeah. We would have not have spent so much money. So.
Okay, so it reminds me, like, when I see companies pitching, we're raising X amount, period. So, and one of the advices from Reid Hoffman is actually, like we need this to do that, and this is something that it's exactly what you say. We're gonna take the funds and do the experiments that our potential buyer partner wants to see.
Yep.
Makes a lot of sense.
It makes your path forward very clear, and not, you won't get so distracted by the shiny object syndrome because you know experiments that you need to do because Pfizer told you what they wanted to do. Don't do anything beyond those experiments. So
would you say
scientific decisions too? So like with the Curis company that you mentioned at the beginning was a fatty liver disease company. Mm-hmm. And we knew from our farm, what our potential partner said, that if we can't change fibrosis in fatty liver disease, we didn't have a drug. So when we did our experiments, it was specifically, will we change fibrosis by X amount? And that was our hypothesis. And we did a lot of great things for the liver, a lot of amazing things, but you know what we didn't do? Fibrosis. And if we had focused on the overall package and all of these other things, we would have still be working on that company and working on a drug that no one cared about.
Yeah.
So
that's super helpful for the community. It sounds like, I'm not saying it's a negative, negatively, just like scientists are kind of exposed to this syndrome, shiny objects syndrome, because of the curiosity. And I think what you say, helps a lot, like to understand the how, like,
yeah,
how to, yeah. Like I want, I have the impression that I want to start a company. I have this feeling or this urge, but the how, I haven't heard. So what you say, I haven't heard a lot about this process, but your experiences, I've been through, I'm still in the process. Growing a company, but it makes a lot of sense what you are saying. So thanks for sharing.
It's hard because I would also share that when I wrote papers in grad school, I pictured what the paper would look like and what the figure would look like, you know, of an ideal paper. Like, here's what a PNAS paper is going to look like. Here are all the figures I want to have. And I didn't do an experiment that wouldn't be a figure. Period.
Cool. So let's move on. I have to force myself because the conversation is so exciting.
Sorry. Yeah.
So let's. What was your greatest failure, and how did this translate into success maybe another company or on the same company.
Yeah. I mean, it was the accelerator that failed. I mean, it was a really hard time. I mean, three of our four companies failed their experiments. We had to let people go. We had to fire people. And it was really, really hard. And then you also learn the actual mechanics of how to shut down a company, which nobody tells you how to do because no one wants to talk about that.
Yeah.
Probably one of my most popular talks that I give to students, how to shut a company down. Yeah. But really what I learned from that is like, I started to see what the warning signs were for a company. Mm. I saw the warning signs for like when an entrepreneur was getting too in love with their very ugly baby. And I started to learn how to be very transparent with investors and with the board and gain their trust and know that, that I could get things done. And I also learned that like when to keep, you know, patching the leaks in a boat and putting, you know, patches over those leaks and when to just get out of the boat. You can just leave the boat altogether. It's sinking. It's okay. You can move on. And knowing, you know, picking the battles and showing how you can get things done. And that showed the board, when they were looking to do the accelerator concept again, who they wanted to have at the helm of that. And that was me. I was the person that, you know, made hard decisions. I was always transparent about those decisions and had a really strong moral compass in the process. So, and I think you have to remember that this is not your last success and it's certainly not your last failure, and that's okay. We're all kind of used to it and that you'll get through it.
Yeah. I'm stunned actually how scientists are, they say they're risk averse, but actually they fail a lot in experiments. And actually, I don't understand, because for me, like the business of science, for me, it has become just a sequence of experiments in my mind.
Absolutely.
Like, and then you have, you're not emotionally attached. You just, this is a hypothesis. Yep. This is what we do. This is the data. And then you kind of optimize Absolutely. The hypothesis, validate, falsify, etc.
Yeah, that's the best way to think about it. I mean, it's too easy to fall in love with your ugly baby. And still have passion. I mean, you have to kind of balance that. You want to still be passionate mm-hmm. about it, but you have to know, you know what, this just isn't working. you're right. Like scientists, we just need to rely on the data and what the facts tell us. And sometimes that fact is that you don't have a company and to move on.
So you had this struggle with Accelerator shutting down companies. What drives you to continue this struggle?
I think it was the data set that I now have that like I could get through something tough and that, you know, I can do something new after that. I mean, I know that, you know, sort of there's this, the Rolling Stones song that was my favorite, my dad's favorite, which was that you can't always get what you want, but sometimes you get what you need. And I feel like mm-hmm. that's startups for me. Like I learned a whole bunch and I've mm-hmm. been able to apply that to my companies and I've made better companies because of it. And so, I mean, people say that they learn more from their failures and they're exactly right. So I just know that I got through a really tough time and I was successful and I'll be successful again or I'll fail again. Who knows?
Or you change the hypothesis and optimize it. So
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There'll be another drug out there too. So
cool. And in terms of like, I'm curious about you said that there are red flags when you know there are red flags when founders, I'm just curious about it, when you see something is wrong, like it's the behavior, like, what is it? It is a distraction? Is it just kind of shutting down and focusing on stupid, like irrelevant tasks? What is it?
Chasing money and being torn away from your goal. Mm. So if your platform does XYZ and all of a sudden there's a big pot of money towards this and you change courses completely just because there's money to be had in there. I mean, you see all these researchers going into COVID, you know, and they don't work on COVID. And so you end up sort of diluting out everything that you've worked on and the value proposition of your original thing. And so I think when people start chasing money, when people stop being transparent with their board and with their investors about what's going on, I think, or they're not willing to report things, I think that's another sign as well. Like if you're just, you know, trying to like find the next good piece of data before you ever talk to your board, that's a terrible idea. Your board is there to help you.
So chasing money, being biased by, so you have a strategy, you have focus, you have aligned the resources to do something, then you see a pot of money, and then you just, okay, I'm going to ignore all of this and and do what actually they tell me to do. Is it correct?
Yeah. Deviating from your core mission, your core value proposition, chasing money, not being transparent.
Cool. Okay. In terms of like the whole industry, are there particular sectors where you kind of see or expect growth in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think that as we are developing new ways of addressing disease, we're going to have the technologies around those, particular, the enablement of those technologies. So for example, with gene therapy, you know, being able to deliver and manufacture them. I mean, there are still these huge bottlenecks that we have with cell therapy. That's going to be, so I think we're going to start seeing a lot more transformation in the enablement side of, because cell therapy is incredible, but there's still these huge bottlenecks as it relates to the business model around how do you get cell therapies to patients. And so I think that's where, I think that's going to be some of the biggest challenges and biggest leaps forward. I hope so anyway.
Okay. So gene therapy and cell therapy, like manufacturing is a bottleneck in gene therapy. This is what I learned. And in cell therapy, it's a kind of the production of pluripotent cells, right?
Yeah.
Also the production side.
It's really complicated business model that we're all not used to, allogeneic versus autologous and all of those different sort of, how does that business model work? It's challenging, fascinating, but it has some problems.
And probably in cell therapy also the standardization will be... Okay.
Yeah, and it's so expensive. Like I looked at a really cool cell therapy when I first started Ascend that was in retinitis pigmentosa, and it was really cool. I just knew how expensive it was going to be at this point. Mm-hmm. And as a startup, I knew it was going to be really hard to raise that level of capital that was required to move it forward. So it's gone on, and the founder has been successful at obtaining money, and I'm super happy for him because it was a really cool technology. So.
Is there one wish for future of entrepreneurship in biotech?
You know, I think that the biggest thing is that I wish for entrepreneurs to always remember to give back. And so when they become successful to help others, you know, learn that success and
I miss it so much in biotech. I miss it. That's like what I'm doing here and what we are doing here is actually doing exactly that.
Yeah. It's hard. I mean, I think we get, and you know, it's sometimes it's understandable. I mean, you kind of get wrapped up in your own companies and your own needs and problems. And, you know, I understand that piece of it, but we have to be able to help each other. And you know, why recreate a wheel when I've already done it and I can tell someone else how to do it. And I wish that we took our ego out of stuff, I want to be first kind of person, and just help each other, because drug development is hard and startups are hard. We shouldn't make it any harder on ourselves. So
it's sometimes the conversation and somebody saying, I've heard somebody is doing something, reconsider what you're doing, or I heard that in a particular area something is going on, your technology might be useful there, start evaluating it. And I think this like not every advice was kind of wow, it's working, but at least it's opening doors or closing doors that you shouldn't go through.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes it is the closing door. Like, nope. Absolutely.
That was a great conversation. Elaine, what's the best way to reach out to you?
You can find me on LinkedIn. My email address is I don't know if I can give that here or if there's a way to add it to the podcast.
We'll add it. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. And I have a calendar link too. I keep it. Yeah, I mean, I try to have sort of an open door policy. Wow. I mean, people can throw meetings on my calendar anytime, and I have that with the people that I mentor myself. Of just like, it's just office hours. I mean, it's hard. It's like virtual office hours. Since I don't have an office, come by for a cup of coffee anytime on my calendar. So.
Wow, that was a great conversation. When you're connecting even virtually, it's kind of strange. When you're connected in a room, I sometimes have this goosebumps, so you have a real personal connection. And yeah. I have this goosebumps, so thanks for connecting. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, Founders in Biotech.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us on Founders in Biotech podcast. We'd like to thank CSL Behring for supporting this initiative. If you want to raise awareness on cutting-edge science, emerging technologies, and innovation, please do reach out to us and visit foundersinbiotech.com. See you in the next episode.